that is a rare treat. She's come a long way to be with us today. We had dinner together last night, and I decided last night I'm not going to tell you about her. She's going to tell you about herself, and she'll tell you what she wants you to know. But I can tell you this. But I can tell you this. When I came to Al-Anon, I thought it was very serious. I thought AA was serious, but Al-Anon was really serious. And it was sort of indelicate to laugh very loud. Or, you know, why were they laughing when this is so serious, this life threatening? But the more I came and the better I got, the more I laughed. And I found that's when my healing began, is when I could start laughing at myself, at life, just laughing. What the heck of laughing? These programs are fun, and nobody could have made me think that until I came. This Al-Anon that's coming up here right now is fun. She's a good Al-Anon, and I can't wait to hear Beverly from Fort Worth, Texas.
Good morning. I'm Beverly Ross from Fort Worth, Texas. And I am thrilled to be here. They had asked me a time or two, and I wasn't able to come. And I really think Atlanta invented the word hospitality. We have just been surrounded with the most wonderful, fun people. We have laughed. We have eaten every meal with somebody that was great. There are a lot of good friends of ours out in the audience, like Tony and Skip and lots of people I've known for a long time. And it's always a joy to be asked someplace where you know people, and you know, and then you get to meet a lot of wonderful people like Ruth and her husband and Francis and her husband and all the wonderful people. We just had a great time. I'll usually get up and say thank you so much for the basket that's in my room, but actually the basket is over there sitting under Betsy, and I've been watching them give them away, and I was really getting a little worried. I had looked around and I didn't see my basket, you know, so I was really glad to see it come in. I was getting ready to come up here, and somebody leaned up. The name of this book is How to Be a Gentleman, and it was in my lap, and this man behind me over there said, isn't that supposed to be How to Be a Gentlewoman? And I bought it thinking it said, How to Get a Gentleman. You know? Oh, now I want to introduce you to the gentleman in my life, and his name is Buddy Ross, and if you would stand up, and he is my darling angel. I want to thank everybody for having us, and it's such a joy to be able to travel together, and it's so sweet to be able to come together. I have loved the conference so far. I thought your Friday night speaker was just wonderful and so interesting, and had been in so long. And then last night, that was just beyond a treat. I had not met the speaker last night and not heard her before. And I just thought she was wonderful. You really got wonderful speakers at this conference. I mean, you were just marvelous. Now, I will say I had a little problem. I'm from the South. You didn't have on hose, and you didn't have on makeup. And but I was saying to myself, oh, well. But once I started hearing her, if you have not heard her, it was just, she just blew us all away. She was just wonderful. And thank you for a wonderful talk. It was just marvelous. And you can come without hose any time, honey. Oh, goodness. You're going to get to hear some other wonderful speakers. We love Tom is speaking, I think, Saturday. This is Saturday. Speaking tonight. And he is one of our favorite people. And Ray is in the morning, and you're going to love him. The whole deal is just a wonderful thing. And we're just... You're just blessed. That's all it is to have this. We've been on the end of putting these things on, and I want to tell you, they are hard things to put together, and they require tons of work. And I think everybody ought to give Betsy a hand. I've been there and done that, and it's a lot harder than just hopping up here and speaking and letting everybody entertain you, I'll tell you. Well, Buddy always tells me to start with my Al-Anon joke, and I don't know whether they tell Al-Anon jokes where you all are from here. I see some nods, but at home they tell them all the time, and they're things like, why does the Al-Anon keep her eyes closed when she's making love? It's so she doesn't have to see the AA having any fun. You know, that's one. And, But the deal is, we had a really funny joke happen to us that we sort of lived through, and Buddy loves it, so he always asks me to tell it. And so if you've heard it before, I will tell. This is a true thing. It was not something that, you know, like that. I keep my eyes open. But I want to be sure he's awake. But anyway. Anyway, this is not going to be a serious morning. I'm done. We had about a year into the program, Buddy said, we're going to go to the Virgin Islands. And I said, oh, now this was at the time that everything he said, it was like I was sleeping with God. I mean to tell you, he was wonderful. He had been in AA a whole year. You know how sober they are at a year. And so we're going to the Virgin Islands. So I said, oh, wonderful. Now, our house was 3 months in arrears. I don't know how we were going to the Virgin Islands, but you know, I wasn't going to ask, you know. So he said, now I bought the tickets, but we're not sitting together. I'm sitting here and you're sitting up several rows. Now I know now he bought the tickets that way. He told me that we couldn't get on the airplane seated together, but he had had about enough of me. So I was sitting up kind of at the front on the row, you know. And so he was back there just having a blast, and he is loquacious. If you don't know what that means, you will soon know. In other words, we talk a lot, both of us, and so we vie for the, you know, we interrupt each other all the time, and he'll say, is that a period or is that a comma, you know, because I have to pause for breath every once in a while, you have to breathe, you know, and then he'd jump in, you know, so he didn't want that little thing going on, so he was back there with his own little group talking, and so back comes the flight attendant. I have to get the correct political word here, the flight attendant. At that time, they were stewardesses. But anyway, so she came down the aisle, and she said, you know, coffee, tea, or do you want a drink? Coffee, tea, or do you want a drink? And so when they got to him in this loud voice, he said, oh, I don't want a drink. I drank my way into Alcoholics Anonymous. And she went, Alcoholics Anonymous? And I'm up reading a book, like, what in the hell happened to anonymity, you know? And he is saying, oh, yes, I just drank. And she said, oh, my, tell me how you got to Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, he told her, and I mean, he started, they quit serving drinks. They were in the back of the plane. They were saying, back here with the drinks, back here with the drinks. And somebody was saying, there's an alcoholic in the front of the plane, you know. Anyway, this man sitting next to him, I mean, it was just bizarre. And so he turned around and he said, but now if you want to hear the rest of the story, you need to ask my wife, Beverly. She's sitting four rows up there on the aisle. Well, you know, I kind of turned and waved to the plane. They all gave me this sad look, you know, like life was, as Ruth said, it was not funny back when he first came in. So anyway, we go down to this resort, and I'm down on the beach. I haven't been to the beach in 20 years, so I'm really excited, and I'm all stretched out. And up walks this lawyer that had been sitting next to him on the plane and said, I have been looking for you. You're the one married to the alcoholic. And I said, yes, you know. And so he said, well, tell me what it was like to be married to an alcoholic. So I started telling him. I didn't like lawyers. I didn't like him. I'd hated the thing in the plane. So it was kind of like, blah, 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 blah. And then I joined Al-Anon. And he said, joined Al-Anon? You can't join Al-Anon. What do you mean? And I said, certainly you can join Al-Anon. Al-Anon is for the friends and families of alcoholics. And he went, my God, I have been an assistant district attorney. We have sent people to jail for their alcoholism. And we have sent them to AA for their alcoholism. And until this moment, I thought Al-Anon was the pill they gave AAs to keep them sober. Well, honey, I was a pill, but I didn't keep him sober, I tell you. Well, I love Ruth was sitting over there with the book a minute ago, and she opened it up, and it's in this giant print. I think as we get older, you know, we're all aging. You know, they had this print, you just can't believe it. I was so tickled and said, now I've introduced myself. That was so cute. But really, the books are pretty specific. We're supposed to tell what we were like, what happened to us, and what we are like now. And I'm a Texas woman, and I'm very proud of being a Texas woman. So I'll start off with that. And we came to Texas a couple of generations back, and we've been in Fort Worth, Texas, for our buddy's family since 1900, and mine shortly thereafter. And so our roots go really deep. I say we were born, reared, wedded, and bedded in two blocks, and that's really about the truth. All of it. Not necessarily in that order, but anyway, so we love our town. And I was born into a family. My father was head of an oil company, and I was a Depression baby. And Buddy's family were in the, had the Steinway piano dealerships for the state of Texas, and they were very involved in the music world as his, as far as that kind of thing. So they entertained a lot of people like Arthur Rubinstein and people like that. My family were much more conservative than his family. And I deal with this, and everything I'm saying I have his permission to say. But, you know, when you meet somebody, it's not just they drank. I just love the fact she talked about, and several people talked, the Friday night speaker, about, you know, we did a lot of crazy things before we ever got involved, before I married the alcoholic or before the alcoholic had anything to drink. But our family systems, although we were both WASPs, you could say, his father was a founder of the country club, and that's the country club my family always went to, and we just had very parallel lives, except he was older, a little bit older than I was, and so I didn't know him in high school or anything, but we still had all these differences. And but anyway, we have been there a long time, and we started out, when I was about 12 years old, I realized there was a subject out there called sex, and I didn't know anything about it. I really, really didn't. And I was a big book person. I started reading. I can't ever remember when I didn't read. So anything I didn't know about, the public library was always to be the source. And so I got a little basket, and I went to the public library, and I was 12 years old, and I had little round gold glasses, little braces on my teeth, and I was real short. And I looked up, and I said, I'd like all your books on sex. And the woman said, we don't give little girls books on sex. I mean, you know, this was just horrible. In fact, they didn't even say that word in nice society. You know, and she was horrified. Of course, my mother would have been horrified, but I was going to go to the source here. I mean, I wasn't going to ask my parents. I mean, how would they know anything about anything like that? And so, anyway, she wouldn't give me the books. But I thought, well, I'm going off to Wisconsin to this girls' camp, and there are 500 girls up there, and I'm going to take a notebook and a pencil, and some of those older women, like 13, 14, 15, can teach me everything there is to know about sex. So I got a pencil and I tied it on this notebook, and I went to camp. Well, all they talked about were jokes, and at that time, all the jokes were about the farmer's daughter and the traveling salesman. They had sex. And so I wrote down, and of course, I didn't know any of the verbs, and so the first verb was the F verb, and I said, how do you spell it? And they spelled it, and I said, what does it mean? And they told me, I went, you know, and I wrote that down, and then the next word was S-C-R-E, so same as above, you know, so I had a little vocabulary list. I didn't think it was funny at all, and they thought I was weird, because every time they tell a joke, I'd run up with my notebook and write everything down and make them define the you know, the spelling words. So they don't give you time to study books like that, but I filled up a notebook, and I'm going to say it was 100 pages, I don't know, 150, but the notebook was full by the end. It was an 8-week camp. So I come home, everybody else is doing tennis, you know, I'm studying for my future, and so I come home on the Santa Fe Chief, and I jump off in Fort Worth, and my mother's there, and everybody, we're hugging and kissing, and I suddenly realize I have left that notebook on the train with my name, address, and telephone number in the front of it, filled with the most horrible jokes you have ever seen in your life. I lived in free-form anxiety, or whatever that is, for quite a while, because I thought somebody would call and ask my very proper parents, you know, we have this notebook that is surfaced on the Santa Fe Chief. But anyway, what happened was, so I lost my textbook, and I was just becoming obsessed. Well, I needed to know, but I wasn't going to ask any of my friends. I wasn't going to ask anybody for fear they'd know I didn't know. So What happened was that year I happened to meet C, the man that I have loved every moment to this second. And during that year I had heard about this man, young man, and he was a freshman in college, and he was at Kemper Military School in Boonville, Missouri. And at Christmas I looked across and I saw him, and I tell you, it did for me everything that alcoholics talk about the first drink doing for them. I mean, I looked at him and it was just like, oh my God, my whole life changed. You know, I was going to marry him. He was going to be the father of our children. All of this was just going to be wonderful. Now, he had never even seen me, but it was all over, and it was. I mean, he had not a clue. So I'll tell you, if you're out here trolling this weekend, how I got him. Every time I would see him, I would start going, there he is, isn't he gorgeous, isn't he adorable, isn't he the cutest thing you've ever seen? Well, you notice people that talk about you like that. And so he finally said, who is she? I was circling him, you know, like you do. And so, anyway, we went out. He came back from school in June, and we had our first date, and he asked me out, and then I went off to that camp again. And that summer, I gained I was really excited. I was madly in love. We'd had two dates. I mean, the prophecy was coming true. You know, there's certain people that believe those things. If you visualize, you know, it will come true. And a lot of people really think that. It worked for me. I don't know about you all, but just concentrate all the time on him and you get him. Now, that's another story, but that's why I'm up here. You know, I got him. So... The Chinese have a proverb that says, may all your dreams come true. And that does not necessarily, they think of it as a curse. But anyway, I went off to that camp and I gained 20 pounds. I guess I ought to glance at the clock here. Okay. Woo. And I gained 20 pounds and I gained it all up here. And I like to say I was blessed by the chest fairy. But what happened was I went off and I didn't even wear a bra. I was straight up and down as a little string. And I... I know I was growing before that, you know. I had not, when I met him, I hadn't even been through puberty or anything, you know. And so here I am, I'm now in puberty, but I'm looking at myself, and the reason I'm looking at myself, we're taking naps, and suddenly I notice I'm growing. And at first that was sort of exciting, and then I got terrified they wouldn't stop, you know. And I'm looking at myself, and now, first thrilling, now terrifying, you know. And so... the counselors noticed I needed help here, and so they took me down to Chicago and trussed me up in this brassiere, and I don't know what size it was, but it was already a C cup or something, you know, and I didn't know how to walk, you know. I mean, suddenly I was overbalanced. I'd always been very athletic, and suddenly I had this weight in the front, you know, doing like this and like this. And I weighed about 103 or 4 when I went off to camp, and then I weighed 123, and I was the same size every place except here. And so, but I was thrilled because this was more ammunition, you see. Was he going to be thrilled when I got home? And so I practiced walking, you know, they got me this, I practiced walking. I had my first little pair of little high heels about that big, and they were kind of throwing me off. And then I joined the Episcopal Church, and I went down to the bookstore, and I bought a cross that I like to say went nipple to nipple. You know, it was this big, and I was kind of like, swinging my cross, you know, I would come forward with my bosoms, and I was a mess. But anyway, so I get home, and I step off the Santa Fe Chief, and he is there with my mother. And my mother burst into tears when she saw me because I had on this tight sweater, you know, and I was standing sideways, you know, so you get the full view. Now it didn't matter if I didn't know anything about sex. I could just turn sideways and you'd think I did. And so, anyway, he went, oh my God, when he saw me, and I knew I had him, you know. So that was the start of our romance. And, he was a 19-year-old B-17 bomber pilot, and I need to put one more sentence in there because afterwards people will always come up and say, what theater were you in, Mr. Ross? Well, he was in the Gulf. He just kind of flew around out of Biloxi, but where he drank a lot and getting ready for our nuptials. But anyway, I went off to the University of Texas, though, and I'm a big fan. Actually, my nickname is Bevo. It is not from the steer, which is named Bevo, but from a cheap beer. I think this is funny. That was around at that time. Now, I didn't drink, but somewhere, and my name was Beverly, and I ended up being called Bevo, and they used to have these Feed Bevo weeks with big banners and cups and everything, and a lot of people thought it was me, you know, but I didn't get any of the money. Anyway, when I got to the University of Texas, I went into the Texas bookstore, and I said, because I knew, you know, we were going to get married, and I was ignorant about sex, so I said, I need your books on sex, and they said, right back there, and I went back, and I got a book, and I took it, and so for the next couple of years, I studied that book secretly, you know, and made notes, and I mean, I had to go get a medical dictionary, because it was not back in the days where they have, you know, today they have all these books on that subject, but back then they didn't, and so we got married, and the morning after we got married, I sat up in bed and said, now it said on page 4 that you are supposed to do something, and he said, page 4 of what? And so I went and I got this book. By now it looked like a limp Bible, you know, like they wave on television, and he opened it up, burst into hysterical laughter because it was published in 1917, and he thought that was the funniest thing that ever was, and he took it downtown and he showed it to the Rotary Club. And you do not, back in the 50s, you did not want to be known as the woman that had the sex book on the west side of Fort Worth, but anyway, so we started our happy journey that has now gotten us here. We started out, and we have 4 children, and they are wonderful kids, and I usually just go whizzing through and don't talk about the kids, because a lot of times Buddy will be speaking, and he always deals with the kids, but I need to say we had 4 children. We had 3 boys, we have 3 boys and a daughter. They have all come to Al-Anon. Isn't that wonderful? None of them are alcoholics. They are all in Al-Anon. Some of them use it more like a Band-Aid, but then we have our oldest son goes to 2 meetings a day. A lot. He's a captain with American Airlines and has been a fantastic, typical in the alcoholic family of the perfect older kid who did everything right. You know, he goes to the South Pole and winters over with the Russians and Japanese, and he wins the international balloon races at the World's Fair in New Orleans. And, you know, just usually I get to talking about him and people don't think I have 3 other children who are more like us, you know, and they were doing all those wonderful things kids do in alcoholic homes. But then we had a daughter, and she is head of the Chamber of Commerce in Ouray, Colorado, and she is just the joy of our life. We just love her to death. They all are. We just have a happy family. Happy, joyous, and free is what has happened to our family, and we were very, very sick when we got to you all. Our third son, our third child is a son named Chuck, and he used to come and he'd help Buddy tape some in Texas, and used to, and he'd say, could I not be the center of your talk? I would just really enjoy using some of the other children, but he was the more colorful of our children. And it's the only way I can say, you know, like the police would come to the door, you know, and say something like, your son's wolf is trying to kill the cattle at the Fort Worth Stock Show. And actually he'd say to Buddy, the police would say, your wolf is killing the stock down at the stock show. And Buddy would say, I have never had a wolf in my life. You know, I have beagles and I have Siamese cats. I don't have a wolf. And they would say, oh no, Mr. Ross, there's a tag on your collar, that wolf's collar, that says that you have had this wolf neutered. You have a 10-foot fence. We've called down, not all this on the collar, down to the Humane Society where you got the wolf. Well, Chuck would just go down and sign his daddy's name, you know, and buy a wolf, have it neutered, sign his daddy's name, you know, to whatever. And the police constantly were coming to arrest Buddy. Now, Buddy, Chuck was always gone. You know, he was in California or something, but he would always leave us with these little problems. And so finally, that brought Buddy to Al-Anon some years ago. It just got so bad, he could hardly handle it anymore. But it was, it's been a trip. Our baby son went to Alateen, and I always say overreacted and went to India as a missionary. So we have him doing everything. Chuck was an underwater diver and photographer and did some work with Cousteau. They have all had interesting careers, and Al-Anon taught me to let them go and do what they wanted to do, where most of the people in our families put on suits and went downtown and did a 9-to-5 type thing in the bank or the oil business or something. None of them have done that, and they have wonderful lives, and I am very grateful, and they're very grateful to Al-Anon for that. Anyway, jumping on forward, I'm going to run through a day and a night in our life when the drinking became like, Buddy always calls it his sort of kamikaze drinking at the end. I would wake up in the morning, and I would wake him up, and he would take one look at me, and he would throw up.
It was like Pavlov's dogs, you know. He'd open his eyes and he'd see me and he'd throw up. I would drag him to the bathroom. I would undress him, giving him this huge lecture on smoking. I was very anti-smoking. If he didn't smoke, he would not throw up in the morning. Now, we didn't mention alcohol. He was not an alcoholic. You have to understand, he was not an alcoholic. He just didn't understand how to drink. And I spent many years trying to teach him how to have one drink, and then if you feel funny, you don't have the second drink. I found out after I got out of the program, that's what they like, is the feeling funny, and then they go on and have more drinks. But I didn't understand that. So anyway, I would clean him up. I would give him this huge lecture. I would put his shirt on. I would put his underpants on. I would put his pants on. I would zip him up. He would scream, and I didn't care. You know? And so then I would wake the kids up. I don't remember feeding them this last 3 years breakfast, but they survived. And we would get out on the driveway. I'd get them all on the driveway, and we would start going, "Goodbye, Daddy. Goodbye, Daddy. Have a great day at work, Daddy. We love you, Daddy. Have a good day at work." Now, Daddy didn't have a job. And Daddy knew he didn't have a job. I knew he didn't have a job. The children knew he didn't have a job. But the neighbors didn't know that he didn't have a job. So he would back out in this big 9-passenger station wagon that was beaten and the paint was coming off of it. And it was just, you know, it'd go to a stop sign and go, ooh, like that. And we'd wave him goodbye and he'd drive out of the driveway. It was all jumping up and down, cheering him on for his job. And then I'd stuff the kids, the oldest one was gone, but I'd stuff the other three kids into this little Volkswagen that had a little slit window in the back. The old ones did. And it was an old one when we got it. So it had a little bit of money. And so here were the three children and me. And I was a good mother. I picked all of your children up. I'd stuff them in the car. And we looked like little clowns with their heads hanging out. And one time, about 7 years into the program, I was speaking in California. And this man came up after and said, "Why didn't you take the big car and let him have the Volkswagen?" And that had never occurred to me till that minute, you know, to switch cars. So anyway, we would get in this car, and I'd play this game called Motorboat. Stay on the gas, and I'd just roar through the stop signs, and the kids would scream, and I would laugh. Oh, I bet the other mothers don't do that, you know. And so we'd go by the elementary school, and the older ones would start saying, "Jump, jump," because I didn't come to a full stop. And same at the junior high. And when we'd cross I-30 near the high school, the Catholics would start crossing themselves, you know, hoping we'd make it. We'd get into the parking lot. Now, by now, I am very well educated, and I am head of the English department in this big high school. And so I'd jump out of the car, and the kids in high school would jump out of the car, and I would go into my classroom. And I was a big fan of British literature, and in fact, that's what I taught, but a big fan of the romantic poets. And one day I was sitting beating my bosom going, "What can ail thee, knight at arms, alone and palely loitering? The sedge is withered from the lake, and no birds sing." And this, I was sobbing, you know, it was so dramatic. And this big old football player on the front row went, "It just doesn't grab me like it grabs you, Mrs. Ross, you know." But anyway, the minute the first period was over, I would run jump in that little Volkswagen, and I would go home. We were only about 8 blocks or so from the high school, and all the other teachers had things like meeting parents and grading papers. My agenda was to be sure Buddy minded. You know, I didn't care if he sobered up. I just wanted him to mind. And I remember Winnie Eddy from California said that one time, and boy, that was the way I was. If he just minded, we would have had this wonderful life. So, but like anything, you have to test them to see if they're minding. Because you can't trust that they're going to tell you they've minded. He was to go to the public library every day and sit from 9 to 5 because none of our people went to the public library downtown. And I thought in the great tombs of wisdom he would be able to find some marvelous career that he could pursue happily. And so off I would go at second period, race home. He would have wobbled home in that car, gotten back in the bed, because most days I didn't get to go home. He would have put on fresh pajamas. He would be lying there with a vodka bottle. I would run in, grab the bottle, throw it against the room. He would wake up. He would throw up. I'd drag him into the kitchen. Now, I want to tell you, he weighed about 280 pounds, and he was no match for me. I would lift him up off the floor. I could have lifted a truck. And his little feet would start trying to get traction, and I'd drag him in there talking about his smoking, you know, and I'd take his pajamas off, and I'd clean him up and put his pants on, zip him up. He'd scream. I'd laugh, you know. He said by the time we got to AA and Al-Anon, it was a miracle there was any sex left, you know. Anyway, so we that was sort of our journey of the morning. Then I would follow him to make sure he had minded, and I would drop back about two blocks to check and see if he went to the library. Well, he would look back like this, you know, and wouldn't see me and start smiling. Oh, that awful smile they smile when they think they've outwitted you. And then he would turn, and he would turn to this Andy Capp's bar, which, and all of this was in two or three, five blocks of our home. And when he'd turn to that bar, I would floorboard that Volkswagen. I would roar through the stop signs, and I would ram his car just as hard as I could. And I want to tell you, his head would do like this, and it was wonderful. If you have not ram somebody's car who is going to a bar against your permission, it is a hit like you cannot believe. The adrenaline just goes up, you know. It is just wonderful. And when I got to Al-Anon, they told me I had to quit doing that. But it was, I had to give it up. It is the most wonderful feeling. There's just nothing like that grinding, you know. And men like cars, you know, so you're destroying something they really enjoy. But anyway, then I would lean out of the car and I would say, "You get to the public library." And he'd say, "Yes, ma'am," you know, and then, oh, it made me feel wonderful. Now, all of this was happening within about a block and a half of the group that Buddy came into. And when we got to the program, there was no one in the Rivercrest, Monticello area of Fort Worth that thought that Buddy was the alcoholic. They all thought I was the alcoholic, every person. And with amazement, they would say, "You do not mean that sweet Buddy Ross was the alcoholic. I have seen her take her car and drive two blocks as fast as she can to ram his car. He's the alcoholic, you know." And, of course, there is no motor in the front of a Volkswagen, you know, if you've ever driven, I mean, the old Volkswagens. So I was ramming his car, and where his head was doing this, mine was snapping back and forth like this. I never felt a thing. I never felt a thing, except joy. That's the only kind of thing I had. So anyway, I had read this book by Mary Bella Morgan, I think her name is, called The Total Woman. The Total Woman. Has anybody ever heard of that? She has these little tips like wrap yourself in saran and meet your husband at the door. You know, I couldn't do that with four kids. But anyway, but she did say the man that drank at home does not drink in bars. And you can have two drinks before dinner. That is very cultured. And so I bought a bar. I took a course in how to make hors d'oeuvres with little chickens that can do their little wings like that. I bought a book called Mr. Boston's Guide to Drinking. I think it's to alcoholism. But anyway, I was so rigid that today, being the 11th or whatever this is, we drank the drink on page 11. You know, we didn't, you know, tonight we're having, you know, it's the 15th, we're having so forth, you know. So, and I like things that had sugar and fruit and little things that floated and that kind of thing. And so anyway, of course, that's not the way he liked to drink. But right at 5 o'clock, the doorbell would ring. And I would go to the door and I would say, "Who is it?" Now, I didn't give him a key, of course. I said, would say, "Who is it?" And he would say, "It's me." And I would say, "Have you had anything to drink?" And he would go, "No." And I believed him every single time. And I would unlock the door. I would tell the kids. They would go back to their room and play. And there was a door that locked off all the bedrooms. So I would lock their door. And then I would open my bar and my little hors d'oeuvres. And I'd have had little aprons, you know. And, oh, it was just so cute. And I had my little chickens that would do things. We'd do a little toothpick. And they'd swing their little wings and stuff. And, of course, he'd stagger in and sit down. And I'd give him this drink of the day. And he'd drink about half of it and pass out. And I would lift him up like this, and I would go, "You can have another drink." You know, and he'd go, "Okay," you know. So about this time, the kids would be beating on the door. "We want out. We want out. Dinner, dinner." And I would run, and I'd unlock the door. And I was a very slapdash cook. You know, I just threw things on the plate. And the minute Buddy was tired and getting ready to go to bed, dinner was over. So everybody just snatched and grabbed food, you know, because he'd say, "Well, I think I'll go to bed," you know. And so I just start grabbing the plates and everything and running into the kitchen and scraping them and throwing them in the dishwasher, you know. I had to get to bed fast for sex. Fast. And so I was just throwing things and running across the den and telling the children to go to their room. And I'd run into the bedroom and he'd be unconscious. And I'd lift his head up and say, "Do you want sex?" And he'd go, "No." And At Arlington Heights High School, they sent around this little sheet that was about mental retardation. And they were concerned that some kids were sort of like Forrest Gump. They had been lost between the special ed kids and the kids in your class. And it was 20 questions, and you were supposed to look at your questions and look around your classroom and decide if anybody should be and have special help. Well, I looked at the 20 questions. I took them for Buddy Ross, and he failed all of them. And I thought, my gosh, I mean, his eyes didn't focus. He had attention deficit. I mean, he didn't know how to, you know, I mean, he just was a classic case of he had fallen into mental retardation. So I started speaking to him very slowly. I now had to hide the fact that he didn't know how to drink correctly. He didn't have a job, and now he was becoming mentally retarded. It was just almost more than I could handle. So I spoke very slowly to him. They had invented, you know, sticky notes, and I wrote on sticky notes all the time and put them in his pockets, wrote in his hands, you know. Now remember, when you get to the thing, open your hand, you know. Talk to him very slowly. Our goddaughter was getting married, so we had to go to this wedding. And I thought, oh, I don't know that people are going to notice he's mentally retarded. And he got more mentally retarded when he drank, you know. So I was trying to keep him out of alcohol so the mental retardation wouldn't show so much. And so we went to the country club to this reception, and I went to the restroom. And when I came out, I could tell, oh, I forgot to tell you how I was going to handle it. I told him, I have come up with a plan so that you don't drink too much. And I said, I'm going to give you, I tell people who've heard the talk before, I'm going to give you 3 peanuts. And as you have in your right hand pocket, as you have a drink, you are to transfer the peanut to your left hand pocket. I thought it was a wonderful plan. When you reach your hand into your pocket and there are no more peanuts, you have had enough to drink. So I come out, he has drunk more than 3 peanuts worth. I can tell. I mean, we intuitively know. Well, he's talking to one of our very best friends. So I walk over and I put my hand, while he's talking to Tommy, down, put my arm around him, hi, honey, and put my hand down in his right-hand pocket, and I start feeling for his peanuts. They are not there. I am becoming very upset, and I go around the other way, and I reach my hand in and start feeling for the peanuts. They are not there. He has eaten them. So mad. So I like to say we were a dysfunctional family. Or what happened? You know, as I tell you these things, I do have to say, these things were not funny at all when they were happening. They were so serious. I'd never talked to the priest at our Episcopal church. I did not. My parents would come to the door. They lived a block from us. I went up there every day and saw them. But if they came to the door, I'd say, is there something I could do? I would not let them in my house. I did not share with one friend, anybody, what was going on in our household. It was like the most horrible thing. I just hid it all. But today, you know, it's so funny because I look back, it's like it happened to somebody else. It's like a cartoon character or something doing all of those things. And I go all every place telling all these horrible stories that I would never have told. You know, I would have died. I think I would have committed suicide if anybody had known I was trying to wreck my husband's car on a daily basis or zipping him up and dying laughing and things like that. What happened was my husband had, of course, had his moment, and he came to AA. And from the time he came, in 1976, in April the 26th, he, you know, do remember those dates. Getting an Al-Anon meeting, they said, when did you come to Al-Anon? They started going, I think it was spring. He was in treatment. Oh, let's see, I believe there was snow on the ground. They can hardly say when they came, but they always know when he sobered up. So anyway, he had his moment, and he came to AA, and I want to tell you, it was like, if you are here, and the person that you're have a relationship with, that wonderful word we love, relationship, have a relationship with, is not in the program, you are impacting them. I don't care what they say, how they act, or anything else, you are impacting them. They may not like it, but you are impacting them. Because Buddy came to AA, and I had never heard of Al-Anon. This is one reason I told that story. I'd never heard of it in my whole life. I didn't think it was the pill you gave AAs, but I did know I'd never heard of it. So there was no program for me. Now, there was a program for me, but you realize that group was 3 blocks from where we lived. They were not thrilled to have me come. They were not rushing me. No one called and said, how about you coming to Al-Anon? I think they lived in horror that this woman that had been so wild was going to attend Al-Anon. I don't know. Anyway, they didn't ask me. And his sponsor said, don't ask her to come. I mean, they kind of observed what I was like. And I am grateful that I got there on my own, just like he got there on his own. And what happened, I mean, with us, that's the way it had to be. But anyway, he came to AA, and I had thought through a variety of circumstances that AA, anonymity meant not looking them in the face. And so when they'd come to see him through various reasons, I would do this and leave, because I thought if I looked you in the face, you would no longer be anonymous. And so he was always having something happen, like cirrhosis or, you know, little things dropped into our life. And so anyway, they would come see him, of course. And he was very active. He went all the time. He just went crazy in AA, ran around, told everybody, dragged people off of bar stools at the country club, said, I have someplace you need to come with me. And they'd come, shocked, and not speak to him for 3 or 4 years, you know, because he'd drag them to an AA meeting. You know, he didn't get that idea of the program is for those who need it, who want it, not those who need it. And he needed to know that, but he didn't at that time. Anyway, he was just stark raving crazy, and I was acting like nothing was going on, that he was just normal. But what happened was, finally, I was trying to make him go to church with me. And now I had no spiritual life. I was head of the Episcopal women, all the Episcopal women in the Fort Worth, Dallas diocese. I had no prayer life. I just kind of knew there was a God up there. I would sit in the back of the church and think, I wonder if the priest believes all that. You know, that was where my deep spirituality was. But on paper, it looked really good. Anyway, so I told him I wanted to go to church. He said, no, I'm going to AA this morning. It was Sunday. And I said, well, I am going with you, and I'm going to take this notebook and this pencil, and I'm going to put every person, I'm going to look every person in the face. And then I'm going to put their name in this notebook, and they are not going to be anonymous in Fort Worth, Texas anymore. I was darling to live with. And so he knew the power of the program, though, and he said, okay, and he took me. And I walked in that Sunday morning into the Harbor Group in Fort Worth, Texas, and found just what I find here. All of these people laughing and hugging and having a wonderful time. And as Ruth said, it was joyous laughter, you know. And my gosh, it was a whole room full of alcoholics. I love alcoholics today, but oh my God, I wanted to take them all home and zip them up and, you know. You know, they were just darling. And the cutest people I have ever seen in my life were the women in AA. Oh, they were adorable. I mean, they looked like horror. The skirt slid up, no hose, you know, and all the, you know. And so they were so cute. I wanted to be one of them, you know. And so I'd read the big book cover to cover, had corrected every single grammatical thing in it. And so I said, I want to join AA. And they said, no, I just said, I'm going to join Alcoholics Anonymous. And they said, well, tell us a little bit about your drinking. And I said, listen, you should have been in our household. I didn't have time to drink. Somebody had to earn the money. Somebody had to take the kids to school. Somebody had to do it. And they said, honey, you need to be with them. And when she said them, I looked over, and we all had hose on. We all had makeup on, and we all looked grim to me. And so I said, I don't want to be with them. Now, while I want to be with us over here, the fun people, I don't want to be with them. They look too serious, you know. They didn't color their hair, you know, a lot of us. Ugh. And so, but the thing was, through this year he had been in AA, it had finally occurred to me there might be an auxiliary or something out there, and I did not want him volunteering me. So I said, buddy, if there is anything, this is before I got that first date to you all, I said, if there's anything in over there at the Harbor Group called Alcoholettes, I'm not going to be interested in being a member. I said, I have been a Rotary ad, and I have done this, and I've done that, and, you know, I've done everything for you, but I am not going to be an Alcoholette. And so he didn't even correct me. He just said, okay, you know. As I said, they weren't rushing me. So when I appeared that day and wanted to join AA, and they told me, well, you need to be with them. I said, I am not going with the Alcoholettes. I said, I am going to be a woman in Alcoholics Anonymous. I promise you, I'll be a wonderful member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, and furthermore, oh, this was so bad. I just can't believe it. I said, you cannot keep me out. Because I have a sincere desire to stop drinking, and that is the only requirement for membership, and you cannot keep me out. And I want to tell you, I don't know about the women in Georgia, but the women in Fort Worth, Texas, and the Texas women kept me out. And I mean, they kept me out. They stood at the doors and kept me out. They took me to lunch and kept me out. They kept me out of the program. And the gift they gave to me was they handed me a big book, and they said, we want you to go through the big book, and every place it says alcohol, put control, and every place it says alcoholic, put Beverly. And you will find it fits you very well. And so they mentored me for 1 year. 1 year. It was just amazing. And I am so grateful to the women of Alcoholics Anonymous that the integrity of the Texas women is they didn't let me in just because I wanted to come. Because I'd have never gotten well in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had no problem with alcohol. You have a drink, you feel funny, you don't have another drink. I mean, that was not part of the alcoholic program there. But I have a big problem with him. I have a big problem with controlling the alcohol and controlling him. So anyway, so I said, fine. So I read the book, and I did what they told me, and I took the steps in my head and waited for him to make his amends. And he came in one day and said, if I bothered you in any way or anything that happened, I'm sorry. I thought, that's it. Only like 10 weeks of on his knees weeping, you know. But anyway, I had no problem with the fact that alcoholism is a disease. I will say that in my defense. I really knew that if Buddy and I had started out drinking, started the same way, and if I'd had a problem with alcohol, I would have been an Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't. It just never did for me what hitting his car did. It just never did for me what I hear you all say. It never did for me just looking at him. When I first, it was just wonderful. So I was just hooked into him, he was hooked into the bottle, and that's the way we got sick. But it was not like he went out and decided he was going to be an alcoholic and mess up everybody's lives. It wasn't like that, and I'm a firm believer in that. And reading the big book with the doctor's opinion was the greatest thing that ever happened to me. And I know that there is controversy about the big book, but and I do not speak for Al-Anon, I only can speak for myself, but I am grateful for me that I came in as I did. I'm grateful that I keep a big book. I read it all the time. I adore the Al-Anon literature. It is. When I got here, my sponsor had me read July the 1st every day for 6 months. And July the 1st in the ODAT is the man that I married is not to be the source of my happiness or my sorrow. My life is my life to live alone. So we each follow our lonely path. I won't quote it, but I certainly know it. And I love the Al-Anon literature. It has saved my life. But to get there, I needed to come through the big book. I would have never been in Alcoholics except that Buddy was taping, and he asked me to go to a conference. And that's why I love conferences and why I try to come every time there is a conference, because I think this is the icing on the cake. And there may be somebody out there who is not in the program or who is marginally in the program. And I think conferences make a big difference in whether they get to the program, because I was sitting in the second seat, I guess, about there, and that's always where God sits for me, because I went to a conference down in Longview to the East Texas Roundup, and I went to every meeting. I just loved it, but as we were going down there, I said, Buddy, I am not in Al-Anon. I now need the name. I never intend to be in Al-Anon. I'm not an Al-Anon. I don't ever want to be, but I want to go to the conference. And he said, and I won't wear a badge that says Al-Anon. And he said, honey, there is not a person in Fort Worth, Texas that thinks you are an Al-Anon. And I thought it was a big compliment, you know. So we got there, and that year they had red badges for the AAs and blue badges for the Al-Anons, and they went out and got a special badge that said visitor on the top and put my name on it. And that's how I went to my first conference. But I went to all the speakers, and when I, on Saturday morning, I heard, the angel in my life and that carried the message, or the Eskimo, or whatever you want to call it. And I wouldn't have gone. I don't know. I guess I would. I just was attending all the speakers' meetings. I was having a great time. I didn't know it was the Al-Anon meeting. And it was Gracie A. from Dallas, Texas. And she is quite different from me in many ways, exactly like me in many ways. And I sat in that second chair, and God came to me. And I cried silently. I hadn't cried in years, except quoting Keats. But anyway, here I wet the whole front of my dress, and at the end, if she'd said, come up and we're going to cut your wrist and we're all going to bleed together. I would have run up there with the knife and, you know. And I joined Al-Anon in that chair, and I know the date I came, and it was April the 2nd at 11 o'clock in the morning, 1977, and I have 22 years and a half in the program, and I have been... And all it did was save my life. I was in and saved my marriage and saved my children. My body was a mess. I felt no pain. I mean, teeth would abscess. I felt no pain. I had not one feeling of pain when I got to this point. It was wonderful in a way. I mean, nothing ever hurt. I was hospitalized, couldn't move with a bad back, and the man said, "What is going on in your life?" And I said, "I have four wonderful children, a fabulous husband, a great job, and I need to get out." You know, my feelings were killed, my body feelings. It was really scary. I don't know whether you've ever had that happen, but a lot of people come in numb to both programs, I'm sure. And so I know it saved my life. And my blood pressure was horrible, everything. I won't go into all that stuff, but it was. And I am very healthy and have a wonderful life today, physically, spiritually, emotionally. I was given a God, a real God, not one to stand in the back of the church and look at the priest and run all the church. He is very precious to me, and I am very precious to him. And I was sleeping with God, as I told you, and when you're sleeping with God, it's a little difficult to have a God. And so my sponsor started out with me and tried to unravel us, basically. And, you know, when you start out at 13 years old and you live in 27 years of alcoholism, which is what we had gone through, your lives are pretty tangled up. And so he was convinced she hated him. And that they were teaching me to go upstairs, took me upstairs, were teaching me to say, "Buddy Ross is an S of a B," because that is not what Al-Anon does at all. Buddy Ross was never even mentioned in a meeting. He couldn't believe it until he got to Al-Anon. He thought he was the subject, you know. But anyway, but she had to teach me to learn boundaries, and she had to teach me to learn how to live. And that's what my first sponsor did for me. She is deceased, but she gave me the most wonderful gifts in the whole world. She taught me how to mop. I was reared in a household with lots of help, and I knew how to make scrambled eggs and fudge when I married. And I'd never mopped, I'd never ironed, I don't know who they thought I was going to marry, but not into this world. And so I was not a horrible housekeeper, but the way I'd keep house, I'd just open a drawer and just sweep everything into the drawer so it all looked good, but it was a mess, and I was a terrible cook. You know, I was the best. And so she just taught me all the basic things. And, you know, when you get a sponsor, and this is the only preaching I'm going to do, I sponsor about 20 people right now. That is just, I'm retired, and I love to sponsor a lot of double winners because I try to pay back to them what they did for me. But I think it's important you don't go try to find somebody just like you. I was just like me. I didn't need somebody to teach me how to be me. I needed me to teach somebody to teach me how to be a normal, functioning member of Al-Anon. Well, anyway, she was great, and I loved her. And what happened in the program was I had, we started our recovery, and we had several things that, as you know, it's painful. As you know, they say if you're not in tears when you come in or on your knees when you come to the program, you'll be there after you're there a while. Well, I came in fine. My husband had a year in AA. I was fine. Everything was wonderful, you know, and so when I looked at my life, what happened was I realized I didn't handle suicide well. And I'd lost several friends who had lost a child or something with suicide. And I'd keep thinking, I'll go see them, and I just wouldn't. Well, in inventorying and talking to my sponsor about the loss of one of these friends and how could I make that up or what kind of amends could I do, we started talking. And when I married Buddy Ross, I just, you can probably tell us, I'm a very enthusiastic forever friend. It doesn't matter. I mean, when I love you, I'm going to love you. It doesn't matter what you do. Or if you don't love me, I'm still going to love you. So you just give up. That's what they usually do. You know? But anyway, and I've kind of lost where I was going with that. Oh, yeah. And so I had married Buddy. Yeah, just a small thing, mother suicide. Just flipped my mind like that. What had happened was, I bring my proctor. Anyway. But anyway, I just adored his mother and daddy. They were the cutest things that ever were. They were as adorable as he was. And the person I just clung to and adored was Buddy's mother. She was the most adorable woman I had ever seen in my life. We hooped and laughed and had a wonderful time. Both of her children were alcoholics, and she had this crazy daughter-in-law. But, of course, we were both really pre-Al-Anons. We should have been in Al-Anon and weren't, and so we just kind of, we became just a little twosome. Now, we never mentioned alcohol or anything like that, but we had a wonderful time, and she had a great sense of humor. And one day, this woman I just loved more than anybody in the world, except my immediate children and husband and my mom and dad, took a knife and cut her throat. And we got there before the ambulance and the police, and I remember taking Buddy's hand and saying, "It's not your fault. It is not your fault." And I'll tell you whose fault I thought it was. I thought it was mine. And it was a horrible experience. It was a lot of blood. It was about a year before I could look at red again. And what I did was what I did with everything. I just left it, and it didn't matter. And she died, and we went on, and I didn't have any grief. I didn't have any pain. I didn't have any physical pain. I didn't have any emotional pain. And what happened is that had stayed with me. And I couldn't handle suicide. I couldn't do anything. Well, in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it talks about your dark past can be your greatest asset. And that probably isn't the exact quote, but it's something like that. And it was certainly true for me. Because I can work on a suicide hotline today. I've had three people I sponsor have kids commit suicide, and I can fly to them and be with them and stay with them and be perfectly comfortable going through it because we have gone through it. And I'm just so grateful today for the experiences and how God can take terrible evil and make good out of it. I mean, I don't think God causes evil. I mean, this is my own belief, but I think good can come out. And look at us. We are all living miracles of good can come out of bad. But anyway, that was the first gift of Al-Anon. And the second was that, of course, here I was. We were now this little AA Al-Anon couple, and I just adored my husband, and everything was wonderful. He was working, and now working enough that he was getting ready to retire me, and oh, life was just absolutely fabulous. And we were speaking a little bit, and one day I knew something was wrong with our marriage. I mean, everything was great. I mean, our spiritual life was good, our physical life was good, and sexual life, every part of our being, our intellectual life, everything, all the parts of your being were wonderful, seemingly wonderful, but there was just this little nagging thing. So one day when I was having my quiet time, I just said, "God, something's wrong with my marriage, and I want to be the kind of wife you want me to be." And this is nice, I've lost my watch. I know the taker will be thrilled. Oh, it's on my arm. Oh, well, we need to end this up. But anyway. So one day I said, when I was praying, I said, "I want to be the kind of wife you want me to be." I am so grateful I did not say, "I want to be the kind of wife Buddy Ross wants me to be," because I would have been in bad shape. But don't ask if you're not going to receive. And what happened about 3 days later, we were talking about something, and I said, "This is not what the problem is. There's something wrong with this marriage." And he said, "Yes, there is. They have told me not to tell you." This is they, or you all, the AAs. "But I don't love you anymore. I don't hate you. I don't love you. I just don't have any feeling for you whatsoever." Now, I was devastated because I absolutely adored him. And it was like, and when he stopped and said, "Yes, there is," I thought he was going to say, "I had an affair." And I thought, "I can handle that. I may kill her, but I can handle that, you know, just fine." But he said he didn't love me. So I went to the library, which was always my source, and I said, "I want all your books on divorce." And so they gave me these books, how to divorce and get everything, how to divorce and kill them, how to divorce and be best friends, you know, and all that. And I had my little reading material, and I came home, and he was there, and there were flowers, and he put his arms around me and begged me not to divorce him. And I beg isn't really the correct word, but it sounds good to me. That he'd like to, for us to try to build our marriage according to the traditions and the steps and really let God build our marriage. And so this is what we decided to do. And we went to a lot of couples that were in the program. Some are still married and some are not. And sort of let them mentor us, and then we took the traditions and we rewrote them because they worked for the groups and they worked for us, and we had to do them all, and they're not easy, because when we got to the seventh one, and I won't go through them at all at this time, but the seventh one says, you know, we have to be financially independent and we have to be self-supporting. Well, we basically were self-supporting. We had run through about $2 million in this period of the alcoholism. But I had this dad that had, and my mom, who were very wealthy, lived very conservatively, but were very wealthy, and they would just give us two cars. Or they would pay the country club up for a year. Or they would pay the house up for 2 years. And I'm not even talking things like giving the children $1,000 a month and things like that. And there was just money we were running, we had run through. And into the program, we were not financially independent. And what happens is he who has the gold, it's like the golden rule, rules. And so what was happening, it was very emasculating to Buddy, because my daddy was basically the safety net. You know, in other words, no matter what happened, I knew we could be bailed out up here. Now, I never asked for money because I never discussed any problem in our household, but they were terrified. They were watching us just go down the drain, and so they would do these things. Well, now we were in recovery. Now Buddy was making money. I was still working, and we were still receiving these gifts. So we practiced and practiced, and we went up to them, and we said, we can no longer take gifts, you know, because we need to be financially independent, and we appreciate everything you did. You saved our lives, but no more gifts. And we were really scared. We didn't know whether we could cope that way, and we were just going along, yes, no more gifts. And about that time, Buddy looks up and says, but now listen, we're not talking inheritance here, you know. It somehow ruined the moment, but anyway, I don't know. You want me to tell the rat story? Okay. This is I will kind of end with this, because this was one of those. When I come off the podium, I usually tell the cat story, the Thanksgiving story, the wolf story, and the rat story. So I will tell you the rat story, because people come, why didn't you tell the one about the oranges? But anyway, what happened was, back in the drinking days, right before he got sober, I was very rigid. I was going to have the perfect Christmas. And I had the perfect Christmas tree. And it was flocked. And I had these balls that were red. And they had little bows that were plaid. And I had a little rhinestone in the center of a little bow. Now, nobody could come near the Christmas tree. No child was to approach the Christmas tree. This was going to be the perfect Christmas, and they were not going to mess it up. And so I had all these packages wrapped in plaid that matched the balls and, you know, and the old thing. And one day I looked down, and I see our Siamese cat walking by the tree, and it looks just the same color. And I think, I know what I'll do. I'll go down to the pet store, and I will get red cat collars that match those balls, and I will put a plaid bow on it with a little rhinestone, and then we'll be all color coordinated. Now, if you know Siamese cats, they don't color coordinate well with anything. They don't do anything very well except love on you. But anyway, so I go down to the pet store. I get the pet collars. I've seen them advertised. As I'm exiting, I see a Boston Bulldog, little darling thing, rolling in her little blanket. Cute as a little button. I know I mentioned that because by now I am babbling. I do need to tell you. Babbling all the time. Not here, but I mean there. And I've written jokes on my hand to keep him awake, you know, and anything. And I'm very enthusiastic, you know, he's dragging. And I'm jumping up and down, cheering him on all the time. And telling him funny stories or correcting him, you know. And so that was kind of our life. Well, anyway, so I come out of this pet store, and evidently, as I was at the door, they had a box of Japanese hooded rats. Black to the waist, white to the tail, kind of cute. Now, I've never had a gerbil or whatever you call it. I don't like things without hair on their tails. I mean, I don't like rodents at all. But these were sort of unusual. They were standing up there. So as I get home, I'm babbling around, and I know I'm talking about this Boston Bulldog. But you see, he is mentally retarded. So he does not hear anything, but I saw these black and white Japanese rats. So this is before Christmas. So he rings the doorbell. He still doesn't have a key, of course. He's not sober. So I go to the door. Who is it? It's me. Have you anything to drink? No. So I let him in. It's 5:00. He comes in swinging a birdcage with two Japanese hooded rats that I swear the bodies are that big, not counting the tails. And they're standing up. The Siamese cats go nuts. They think we have brought their Christmas, you know, home to them. And Buddy has my present because he thinks I want Japanese hooded rats. Well, he made a horrible mistake. He bought a male and a female. And I will tell you, in 27 days, well, first of all, we had to put them up on the top of the bookshelf to keep the cats from getting them. The children couldn't believe Daddy had brought home rats, you know, and they start copulating. And in 27 days, I mean, the kids are watching all this. I'm hiding it up there. I'm putting a little sheet over so they don't see what's going on up there in the rat cage. And they're giving birth to 7 babies. And 4 boys and 3 girls. And I just, when the children were out of the room, I just zipped the little bottom out of the bird cage. You know how you can clean them. And she's going, oh. And I just walked into the john and flushed them down the john. Well, the missionary found me. Oh, she's killed Martha and Joseph. And you know, they wouldn't let me go to the bathroom by myself after that. Well, anyway, so I said, well, they're yours. I don't even want to see them. Well, we had 3 bedrooms upstairs. The boys, the kids all saved their money. They got habitrails, little long yellow tubes that connected to exercise rooms and living rooms and everything. We had, I do not know how many. They said they counted them one time. They had 187. I don't believe that, but they were over 3 bedrooms of them with yellow long tubes that went from bedroom to bedroom. I didn't go upstairs, you see, from Christmas until April when Buddy sobered up. But in about February, I'm dragging home 50 pounds of rat food. I mean, I feed people, so I'm dragging it home. We have funerals every day because people are dying, you know. And one of the missionary is selling tickets to the kids to come watch the rats do you know what to each other all upstairs. It was a nightmare. But I'm ignoring the whole thing. And so this friend of Buddy's comes up to the Kimball, which is a wonderful museum there, to see the Chinese exhibit or something at that time, brings his Tina, his little about 7 or 8 year old, and I'm going to have a cocktail party. So, of course, I make the little chickens and I get over the little bar, and I mean, I have it all ready to go. The only problem is him, you know, and I'm trying to keep him sober and not retarded. I mean, he's really retarded by this time. So we're going to have this cocktail party. I thought, well, we'll just ignore him. This guy talks all the time anyway. And so, like us, we're all friends. So, da da da, is that a period? Is that a common? Blah, 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 you know. Buddy is just kind of standing there, you know. And so he looks down to the little girl, and in his little voice, big voice, he says, Elizabeth, would you like to go upstairs and see all the rats? And, of course, it stops the cocktail party. And I am not about to let anybody go upstairs and see 187 rats. So I said, oh, yes, we have this pair of pet rats. And I said, Buddy, why don't you go up and get Edith, who was named for a member of the family, and bring her down. And Edith was very gentle. And so he comes down with Edith, and he's petting her, and he's weaving like this, and he's showing Elizabeth how gentle she is. And about that time, Edith starts giving birth. And so she has 3 babies hanging on strings here, and we're all just like this, and he's breathing like this with Elizabeth. The little girl is like this, and he says all he could think to do was take his thumb and shove them back. And so he starts trying to put them back up inside. And finally, of course, he can't get them inside, so he just wraps them up, you know, like string, and takes them back upstairs. So cunning, baffling, you know, and all of that. I'll tell you, we have had, though, a wonderful life as a gift. And one of the most wonderful things is to come and be with you all. Yes. All right. The last story will be the orange story, and that is that we had been married. We'd been in the program quite a little while, and he eats all the bananas, all the apples, all the fruit. I mean, I will bring it home, and he munches through it all, and I like an orange every day. So one day I came in, and he had plowed through all the fruit, and I said, now listen, Buddy. Now, I get to tell it because I'm up here, and it's just wonderful. He always says I had a butcher knife. I had a knife you peel tomatoes with, and you don't peel tomatoes with a butcher knife. But anyway, I was peeling tomatoes with this knife, and it was about that long. And so, so I'm peeling the tomato, and he comes into the kitchen, and I am mad about this orange. So I turn around, and I said, because he's eaten my last orange, and I turn around, and I said, listen, don't you ever eat the last orange again. I said, I feel like I'm married to a gorilla. I buy all this fruit, and you just plow through it, and when I get ready to have a cherry or a banana, it's gone. I'm telling you, if you ever eat the last orange again, I'm going to kill you. And so he said, okay, put the knife down, you know. So I forget about it. I mean, he learned. He didn't eat the last orange anymore. And I thought, gee, that worked. You know, if you have something, I didn't do it again. But I mean, now that I'm saying it, it really did work. But anyway, he didn't eat the last orange happened to this day. But anyway, on Mother's Day, which was about a month later, he usually brings my breakfast in, and he didn't, and I kept thinking, wonder when. I heard Chuck and a girlfriend that had come by giggling. They were in the kitchen. I thought, what on earth is going on? So finally, I think, well, he's not even going to bring me coffee. So I get up, and I walk into the kitchen, and I open the refrigerator door. He has emptied everything out of the refrigerator. There are over 125 oranges, and every one of them is stamped, "Do not eat this orange," signed, "Bitch Beverly." Say thanks to you all. Our life is happy, joyous, and free. And thank you for having us.